You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Federal Premium Ammunition. Now, it's turkey season all over the country right now, and if you're looking for a turkey shot that is just going to slam turkeys dead, you need to check out the Heavyweight TTS. Now, it comes in a variety of gauges, whether you shoot a 410, a 12-gauge, or a 20-gauge, this is the turkey shot for you. A lot of cool things going on with this. It has 22% denser material than a standard tungsten, 56% denser than lead. So what this means is that at longer distances, you're getting higher velocities and a more consistent patterning. It has a full-length wad that prevents direct contact off of the extra hard pellets and the bore. And long story short, that protects the barrel. If you want to find out more information about Federal Premium Ammunition, visit federalpremium.com.
Welcome to the Land and Legacy Podcast. We're your hosts, Adam Keith.
And Matt Dye.
This is your number one resource for all things land.
If you're interested in conservation, habitat management, hunting strategy, and rural real estate, this is the podcast for you.
Hey guys, Adam here. If you've listened to the podcast much at all, you know that we love managing for our native plants. Now, we're coming up on the tail end of planting season for native grasses and forbs, but it's never too early to start planning ahead. If you're looking to transform your farm and make it more productive for deer, turkey, quail, pollinators, contact the people at Pure Air Natives to find out how you need to get started this spring so you can be setting your property up for years of productiveness and years of benefits with native plants. Check them out at pureairnatives.com.
All righty, Hunter, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here, Matt.
Perfect, perfect. I mean, I'm good. I certainly appreciate you coming on the podcast. I think that this podcast is going to kind of turn on the light bulb for a lot of people, and I hope that you're excited for it. I know that we are, and it's kind of one of those topics that I feel like a lot of people have like heard the general phrase co-op, but they're like, cool, but I don't know what it means or what it entails. And so it's an awesome opportunity for us to be able to bring you on and have you talk about it, because you have an existing knowledge, working knowledge of co-ops, research, and all these things to be able to add and pull together and really educate private landowners across the country what they are, what the benefit is, and how they can begin to utilize the benefits of forming co-ops. So certainly appreciate your time this evening, and I know that everyone else will. So why don't we just go ahead and get started and allow you to introduce yourself. Give us a little bit of information about kind of how you got started. One, just kind of being out in the field, maybe quick upbringing, and then some educational and experiences professionally to provide some background knowledge on yourself.
Yeah, well, thanks, Matt. I appreciate it. Like you said, it's I'm really looking forward to this podcast with co-ops and being able to shed some light on the topic through my experiences. You know, I grew up in Georgia, Northwest Georgia, in a little tiny town, and we grew up on some acreage. We had 30 acres as a family, and started hunting and fishing with my dad, like a lot of us do. And, you know, through that experience, I got connected with the QDMA. Mm-hmm. It was funny. Growing up, my dad, you know, when we were, my first deer was a four pointer, and like a lot of us, and we never really practiced QDM or, you know, had a co-op or anything like that. And growing up, we, you know, that was definitely prevalent. Sure. Just going out there to brown us down. That was what we did. You fast forward a little bit, I think I was around 10 or 11 and I started, you know, wanting to harvest large deer, and started getting, came home, and there was, my dad went to a hunt club meeting.
Okay.
Down in middle Georgia. And it was a hunting club, QDM hunt club. And they had this, meeting with at that point in time, a QDMA biologist. It may have been Brian. I don't know, but, they handed out magazines. He brought a magazine back. I remember sitting in the car looking at that magazine and realizing that, hey, this is totally new. This is something, I mean, this was probably, you know, 2006, 2005 time range.
Yep.
and I was, you know, extremely young. I was in middle school, and I was just sitting there thinking, this is totally new. This is totally, you know, different from what we've always done. You know, fast forward a little bit, I sent an email to the founder of the QDMA, Joe Hamilton. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying, you know, this is, you know, I would love to grow up. I read every article in there, and they were all done by wildlife biologists. And I emailed him and I said, hey, Joe, I would love to, you know, Mr. Hamilton, you know, yeah, at that age. And I said, I would love to, you know, be a wildlife biologist. What classes do I have to take in school?
Sure.
I still have that email printed out,
you know, on
the wall, pretty much, to him. And he emailed me back 2 weeks later. He was in Australia, and he said, hey, we are, you know, Hunter, it's admirable that you're at this age and, you know, sixth, seventh grade, whatever it may be, and you're thinking about being a wildlife biologist. You know, I'll do whatever I can to help. So I never responded. It took me about 2 years to respond. You know, I was in middle school, didn't think much of it at that point in time. Emails just coming on the scene. And
sure.
And I reached back out and I said, you know, I would love to come meet you at a convention. And in 2010, I guess 3 years later at that point, I went up to meet Joe and Matt and Kip with the QDMA and met them up at convention and had a quick meeting with them. I was doing a research project in high school, actually, for an agri-science fair that we were doing in National Agri-Science, and with whitetails, met with them, bounced some ideas off of them, you know, as they were the upper echelon of deer management and research who everybody looked up to and wanted to be, you know, get information from the best. And
certainly
we met there and got to meet all of them there. They sat down, they were extremely, you know, nice to sit down with a 10th grader at the time, and for almost an hour at the end of their convention, just sit down one-on-one and talk over this, you know, this research project. So kind of that melds together my love for research and deer and deer management, but got involved there. You know, fast forward another couple of years, I got into UGA, graduated from high school at University of Georgia, and my, you know, I still wanted to be a wildlife biologist, came into UGA, and we got introduced into the Warnell School of Forest Natural Resources, got accepted, and started, kept up my relationship with the QDMA and Brian and Joe, and I was offered, you know, I went to conventions for 3 or 4 years, and I volunteered my time essentially as a worker.
Okay.
For free. Yeah. And did not expect anything of it, just wanted to help the cause. And as a sophomore in college, I was, you know, given an internship.
Nice.
To help out. So I got involved with QDMA that way, just through, you know, selflessness of working and trying to be involved with them. And started out there in my sophomore year of college, stayed there through my second year, my master's at UGA. So I was there for a little over 5 years working directly with QDMA at conventions. It turned in from an internship into a support services coordinator role, really helped a lot with the youth program there at QDMA. It used to be the Rack Pack and then turned into the Field to Fork or that youth program. And then we, you know, continued into other things where I helped start a cooperative at my parents' house back in 2011, 2012 when I was in high school. Continued to help go to cooperative meetings, landowner events while I was with the QDMA, kind of as a point of contact when I was in Georgia when somebody else couldn't go or somebody else didn't have the time. I was, you know, went around and spoke with a lot of landowners, a lot of cooperatives, and slowly but surely, you know, met a lot of landowners across the United States and people with the QDMA. And that kind of brings us to, you know, last couple of years. I was doing my master's and QDMA had some funding and they said, you know, you got the background with cooperatives, you know, helping start a cooperative at your house and working with cooperatives. We'd love to have you do this research. And so we got this research and the funding from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and it, you know, it's now my thesis, my master's thesis, which was contributions of deer management cooperatives to wildlife conservation. So we did some research with cooperatives from 2016 to 2018. Right now, we've just sent in for publication, and I graduated my master's and my undergrad from UGA in fisheries and wildlife management and the master of science and wildlife emphasis. So
nice.
Fast forward to the current day, I'm now, you know, employed, gainfully employed as a research scientist with a consulting company that does research with genetics on pine trees and wildlife and habitat management across the southeastern United States. So I'm, you know, still have a love for this and definitely still very involved with a lot of cooperatives and landowners across the southern United States. So that is a full, you know, point A to point Z pretty much of how it all started and where I'm at. But hopefully that'll give us somewhere to go from here.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, there's several launching points I'm sure we could take from that. But what we really want to do is provide the listeners a great understanding of what a co-op is. So you've been working with them pretty extensively throughout the Southeast, your time at QDMA, as well as through your research project at UGA. So let's just start with the super basic questions, and then we'll work ourselves into the deeper understanding and the value that cooperatives can bring to, one, managing the landscape, as well as managing wildlife populations and different species, and the ancillary benefits of non-game species as well, which everyone knows that we are super big fans of. So let's just provide us with a definition of a wildlife co-op. What does that look like?
So I'll just give you the very first sentence of my thesis is, you know, the what defines a cooperative. And it changes a lot because some people think of it as, you know, one thing and some people think of it as another. And it's a very malleable definition. But the QDMA actually defines deer management cooperatives as groups of landowners and hunters voluntarily working together to improve the quality of wildlife, habitat, and hunting experiences on their collective acreage. So that can really mean, you know, deer. It can mean other wildlife, other game species, other non-game species. But in general, as you said, a wildlife cooperative is a group of landowners or hunters voluntarily working together to improve the quality of the habitat on their acreages.
Right. So is there a size parameter? Does it have to be 100 acres? Does it have to be 1,000 acres? Is it just hey, we're unified as a group now?
It doesn't. No. So a lot of these cooperatives, when they start out, for example, I talked about how we started a cooperative at my parents' house and my property I grew up on. We had 30 acres. That started with a handshake to a neighbor that owned 30 acres and to another neighbor that owned 25 acres. And so essentially you're sitting at 85 acres right there. You're not at 2,000 acres. You're not 5,000. They grow organically. And some can grow overnight. You know, if you have a cooperative meeting for your local area, people that may be interested, and you go from zero to 500 acres overnight.
Sure.
Some grow through handshakes, and they grow organically by the people that are in those cooperatives going to the next property over that touches their property out of almost a selfish benefit to that person. You know, your property, you want the people next to you to practice what you're practicing, so you go to them next, and it grows out kind of across the landscape in that way. But in the end, it does help everybody involved. So I think that to answer your question, there's not really any cookie cutter size. Kind of coming back to the research a little bit, in the research that we found, the cooperatives we looked at, we looked at 45 cooperatives across 5 states. And the average cooperative size varied greatly across areas, which is most likely due to land use changes, as well as generational, you know, how many generations has that land been broken up by?
Yeah.
You know, how quickly have we been, how long have people been there? How many generations have they subsequently been broken up by through passing down to the next generation? And it gets put into 4 tracks instead of 1 or 6 tracks instead of 1. And so you have to look at some of those things. But I think that, you know, some of these in Georgia averaged well over 5,000 acres, while others in other parts of the country averaged 3,000 acres.
Wow.
And there's no cookie cutter way of how they form on the landscape. When you're looking at
areas
in like
shape and everything,
So if you're looking from an aerial, like let's say you take your property, you take a Hunterra map, whatever it may be, and you put that on the land, you look at it from an aerial on Google Earth, whatever. And that it's not a square. It's not, you know, a contiguous body of land, area of land.
Sure.
In some parts of the world, it's a very scattered, almost shotgun approach, where you take an area, for example, Michigan had a lot of these, where you take an area that's a focal area and you say, we want to get as many properties in this 5-mile radius or this 3-mile radius on this management plan as possible. Where in Georgia, almost every single cooperative that we worked with was a private landowner that worked to grow it from a centralized area and they were always touching. Mm. There was hardly ever a piece of property that was on an island by itself off the side of the co-op. It was always through handshakes, through people going door to door with their neighbor, their neighboring hunting club, whoever it was. And that really, from a conservation utility standpoint, is really key by connecting these landscapes. But to answer your question, there's no cookie cutter size. You're looking at, you know, you can have a cooperative, and we actually had one in this research that was 80 acres. And you've got one that, you know, can be 29,000 acres. So you've got this broad range of sizes, but the average cooperative size is somewhere between 3,000 and 5,000 when you take out state and area and region of land use.
So that's a considerable amount. And it's like, I think the constant reminder that we have to go with from the beginning is, just because the average may be 3,000 to 5,000, they're probably all starting with one parcel or just two
for
people
sure.
talking, and it will grow over time. And I think that one, that's one an important reminder, but two, Rome wasn't built in a day. And I'm sure that you've heard this over and over and over again in your research and in your finding, is everyone plays this neighbor game of, oh, well, my neighbor does this. Well, my neighbors do this. And I don't know if I've ever really chatted with landowners who speak highly of a neighbor that they don't know. It's like they always assume the worst of the neighbor that they don't have that personal relationship with. You know what I mean? Like, it's just like, oh, that's how they are. They get categorized right off the bat because, well, they're a neighbor to and they have a similar interest. And it's like, yeah, but I know that there's probably more similarities than there are differences out there. How many times did you run across that when, whether it's your personal experience of starting a co-op or it's through this research that you heard others discuss that?
Well, you hear that quite a bit. But what I've been extremely happy to start seeing is, once you get past that initial, you know, you find one or two people that want to be on a co-op with you,
mm-hmm.
you shake hands with them, and you have this open line of communication.
Yes.
Once you have that open line of communication, you know, one of the things that we, you know, I'll just go back to my personal co-op, kind of give you some baseline, you know, things that I've personally dealt with in forming a cooperative and what I've seen others do. But, you know, we share trail camera pictures. We
yeah.
share, you know, sightings. We share, you know, if one person on the co-op's a trapper, you know, we let them all trap our properties. If,
sure.
You know, whatever it may be. And having that trust with your landowner and letting them know, like, it's extending that olive branch and saying, here's the picture of what we have on our property. Now,
yeah.
Usually they become a little bit more open to saying, well, here's what we have on ours. And then you open those lines of communication and the doors fall down, you know, the fences fall down, and you're more willing to say, oh, well, I know that Joe over here or that Kevin over here is doing this, and they saw this, and it gives you a point of almost a feeling of community.
Sure.
That you know your neighbors, and usually it leads to success through being able to actually have a few of those things open up, a few of those connections open up, and it gives you confidence that not everybody's like that, that you can go do that. And then what you see is the people that, you know, for example, you're in the middle of the cooperative and you got your landowners around you that are on board. Then those landowners around you start seeing the same thing, and they go to the landowners next to them.
Sure.
And it kind of breeds. Maybe it's slow, maybe it's organic, like I said, and it may take, you know, we started out at 30 acres and two landowners right beside us at 80, and now we're right at 1200 acres in Georgia, so we're well below the average. But it's taken us almost 10 years to get to 1200 acres. But the crazy thing is, we went from 600 acres to 1200 acres in 2 years.
So yeah.
it's that just having those connections, having somebody on the outside of the cooperative make a connection.
Definitely.
And doing these things that allow you to grow and sometimes grow exponentially in a short amount of time. But I do hear that, like you said, of getting, you know, I don't want to tell my neighbor this, or he'll start hunting the property line, or I don't want to do this because they'll do that. Yeah, you hear that all the time. And
certainly.
I did hear it some, but what I found most interesting was a lot of these cooperatives have yearly meetings.
Okay.
That's
a great kind of question. Do you find, because everyone is super busy, like, you know, we've got a QDMA branch here, finding volunteers and finding those people to fill roles and occupy among their busy, busy life is it's difficult. So as you discuss this topic or your thought process there, kind of work us through what it takes to organize and run and as a group. What's kind of like the expectation from a meeting standpoint? What does that look like? So if there's someone out there, they want to know what's the commitment to starting a co-op in their area.
So to have a cooperative, you don't have to have a meeting. I don't want that to be one of those things where to say, well, we have to have a meeting to be formal.
Sure.
You don't have to. You can have a handshake. It can be kind of, and that's what a lot of these cooperatives are doing. They're on the landscape.
Yep.
Acting as a cooperative, and they are not being picked up by state DNRs. Mm-hmm. They are not being picked up by conservation organizations. They're not being I can't tell you, there was probably 50% of the cooperatives in Georgia alone were cooperatives that I knew of through other cooperatives that knew somebody in a co-op that was on the landscape doing this without influence from, you know, a DMAT program, a deer management assistance program,
sure,
without a conservation organization. So I think that tells us that there is a large need for some type of, database or some type of group for these cooperatives. Now,
yeah.
I think that we, with these cooperatives and going back to the meeting, like you said, you don't have to have a meeting every year. But to actually do this meeting, I think that we always get caught up in the fact that we don't have time, and I'm guilty,
sure,
of it. You know, I have a full-time job. I'm extremely busy, travel all across the southeastern United States, but you find time for these cooperative meetings because when it comes down to it, if I go to a meeting for an NGO, which is great, banquet, whatever it be, mm-hmm, I encourage listeners to go and support conservation, but you're not that money's going to the greater good, which is great. But when you have a co-op meeting, it's something more personal. You're having,
sure,
your neighbors come. You are positively impacting your ground in one night.
Absolutely.
And it's not a, we're in this for the greater good. It's a, we're in this for the greater good of my community, of my neighbors, of my, like, this point on the map that I am managing, that I'm spending putting my blood and sweat and tears into to produce a food plot, prescribe burn, to do timber stand improvement, whatever it may be. I'm getting a positive impact the next day, whether that be one more landowner that's on board or somebody that may be, you know, thinking about this in a different way than they did the day before when they came to that meeting. So I find it more interesting and actually more rewarding to have a meeting with my neighbors because I know that I'm having a positive influence on my piece of ground, which is what Land and Legacy is all about. So
yes.
I think that is a real key takeaway here because you can have, you know, it's hard to find extra time, but you're, you know, if you're a land manager, if you're a deer hunter, a deer manager, a wildlife conservationist, and you have a piece of property and you're managing it for a set species of wildlife or a suite of species, this is something that can help your property overnight. And it's not, you know, you can find time for that. And it's just like you can find time to plant a food plot or you can find time to do this or that. So I think that's how I talk about it with people when I come in contact. But I do, like you said, I think that just opening those barriers and having an open line of communication is huge for forming these. And then having the meeting every year keeps a form of cohesiveness.
Mm-hmm.
But also it is a good opportunity to learn what your neighbors are seeing. It's a good opportunity to learn who their neighbors are if you may not know them. And I've had many instances where I go to these meetings that I help put on or that I have been an integral part with throughout the last few years, and there'll be an extra, you know, one or two people that's not in the co-op they invite every year.
Absolutely.
And just say, just come experience this with us. Come have a barbecue sandwich with us. Come have a Coke. Let's talk about this just like a camp, you know, that hunting heritage tradition type thing of being able to sit around a campfire and experience this. And it's funny because this past fall, one of my largest co-ops in Middle Georgia, they had this meeting and they had this one guy that came and he had, let's say he had leases to 1,500 acres.
Mm-hmm.
We pulled up a map. It's the first time they'd ever pulled up a map in front of everybody. And the guy said, oh, I know who owns that. He's already practicing QDM. I know the guy that owns that. He's already practicing QDM. And overnight, we added 2,000 1,000 acres
And that didn't happen necessarily. That just happened because of a conversation. Just happened because people were open about sharing some aspects of knowledge that they have about a given region. And I think that once someone carries the torch and says, I'm starting this, I'm going to get going, the doors, it's kind of like a domino effect. Is like I'm sticking my neck out there on the chopping block, and I'm revealing a little bit of secrets. I'm kind of pulling the mm-hmm. curtains back and letting people see kind of inside what's happening. But I'll say this from a habitat, from a wildlife management perspective, people out there who are listening, that is one of the best things that you can do. We're not saying, oh, here's that buck I passed. Here's that 5.5-year-old deer I've got. Oh, I've got three of them on my place. That doesn't have to be the opening line. The opening line is just, hey, here's what I would like to be able to do in the region or in our neighborhood. I'm implementing these types of techniques. I want to reach out. Where do you fall? Are you wanting those same things? If not, that's okay. But maybe we can just have or get into a deeper conversation about that. But if you don't start, you're never going to get there. And from a land mass standpoint, as we continually talk about habitat and the impact that good quality habitat can have for these species and that you're trying to pursue or that you're just wanting to observe on a property, you're only going to get a effect of, okay, let's just say you're managing 120 acres where you can make that 120 acres the best that it can be. But what happens outside of those borders is also very, very important. When we manage a property, we take into account a neighborhood and the land use that occurs in that neighborhood. We're not just managing strictly on what's in your borders, but also what's outside of those borders as well. And that's important to remember. So you've got to go to your neighbors and have this just open conversation about what the heck's going on. And I know I've seen it work, and we've got some folks over in kind of West Virginia, Ohio area, and they're probably chuckling now as I tell them, but I would call them an unofficial co-op. They don't touch borders, but there's 7 or 8 landowners who all want to get together and just enjoy conversation, share resources, and share stories about hunting, what they've experienced, or struggles, or wins when it comes to managing the landscape on their respective properties. But as the crow flies, even though they're in between two different states, there might only be 15 miles apart at most from each other. And so it's just getting people together to start sharing about the impacts that everybody can have. The co-op, sure. I try and like look at, like, let's say both sides of the picture of like pros versus cons. And I have a very tough time coming up with a con list of this. I'm like, why isn't this bigger? Those people who care about wildlife and ecosystems, and because I don't know if we don't use the term often a lot, but like when we're managing properties and talking about, you know, we'd like to see this function as a greater ecosystem. We're talking about micro ecosystems. Ecosystems are regions, neighborhoods, big, huge areas of this habitat type or vegetation type, plant communities. But we can have that impact if people adopt this co-op mindset. And what do you think, Hunter, is like the reason why we don't see that enough out there? We've got pockets, and your research has shown, what was it 12 different states that co-ops are a thing right now? Is that what you were seeing there?
Well, our research was in 5 states right now.
Sure.
I know of cooperatives that are happening across the southeastern United States.
Yep.
that are not part of this research. What we did to kind of frame it in so where people can kind of know when you reference it is we had five states, Georgia, Missouri, New York, Michigan, and Texas. And each one of those was a representative state of the region. So Georgia for the southeast, Texas for the southwest of the Whitetails region.
Sure.
So trying to get an idea of what was happening on the landscape from a landscape context, and as well as demographic context across the Whitetails range as kind of a representation. So these cooperatives are happening all across the landscape, not just in these five states. But for the research, we had to limit it to some point to be able to have large enough data sets to actually run statistics and do things like that. So, but kind of going back a little bit, and I'll touch on your point here in a second, but you talked about the neighborhood. And one of the things that we like to refer to in from a landscape ecology standpoint is the neighborhood effect. You get this essentially from a population dynamics, you know, standpoint, you get this effect of having high quality habitat and it overspills into the neighboring property. So I think that not only from a neighborhood effect, essentially by word of mouth with people, you're getting it from a landscape context, like you were saying. So when you're looking at landscape ecology and how these work, we are able to increase connectivity because essentially you are creating quality habitat across the landscape on this, in this organic manner. When I say organic, I mean, you know, up river valleys, down, you know, ridges, across, you know, areas that, that usually what we found were areas that may be lower price per acre areas, areas that are used for hunting clubs, areas that are not in ag, areas that are fully utilized for wildlife conservation that makes sense that, to connect already, that we were seeing in some of these states. None of that's quantified, but just kind of what you're seeing on aerial. And what's really important is from a lot of states, and I can speak from example here in Georgia, they have these management plans for specific species. Let's say it's quail or the Bob White Quail Initiative or whatever it may be. And they use these local focal landscapes and they try to utilize public lands and DMAP or other, you know, private landowners that are working with them to increase quality habitat in this area, in this given area. And cooperatives are a great way to actually increase that connectivity physically. I mean, you're creating a, for example, a 29,000 acre block of land that's being managed for wildlife, that's having prescribed fires, early successional habitat, timber, you know, timber harvest. You're getting these thins, you're getting these timber stand improvements, you're getting food plots, you're getting these edge effects. And so a lot of the things that we looked at, to kind of put the research in a little bit more context, was like edge density, pass density, interspersion and juxtaposition, all these things that from a, it sound like jargon, but from a ecological side are extremely important. So I think, looking at that effect that you're talking about from a landscape and not just on that one single property on this, this micro site, you're getting a full holistic view of the landscape and how these populations are interacting across the landscape. And being able to influence that is so key to being able to have a quality wildlife management program that benefits everyone within that landscape. And I think that's really where co-ops shine.
Absolutely. And I think it's so important for everyone to, like, we got to pound this home, because if we don't pound this home, then we're not going to see these co-ops, one, maybe just start in your area or grow if you're already in one. But those folks who are out there and they're managing the landscape or they're manipulating the habitat to some degree, you can't tell me, let's just say you've got 100 acres and you're starting to go out there and you're working it, you're working hard, you're seeing the wildlife respond. I talked to a guy today, he owns 27 acres, and he has gone through and just done complete TSI this whole winter. He's cutting cedars, he's cutting hackberry, elm. This is in northeastern Nebraska. And told a story, a quick story. He's like, I don't know how deer were maneuvering through it so thick and dense with all the stuff I've got. But it was snowing. I saw 13 deer and a nice buck come through, and they're feeding on all the tops that I cut. The gentleman's got 27 acres in an area that is heavily ag. It is great corridors for wildlife. But he went in to 27 acres and hit that, and aggressively went in and created a new resource, and has seen these deer, despite it being kind of difficult to navigate at this current time, deer sightings and activity has drastically increased just by doing that on 27 acres. So those guys out there who are putting this stuff to work and are seeing the wildlife basically respond on your 100 acres, you know that. Like, you've seen it. So take that model, or take your mindset out of 100 acres, because sometimes it's like 100 acres can be overwhelming for some people who have full-time jobs to manage and all this stuff. But go 10 times that amount of land. That's 1,000 acres. Now imagine all the benefit that you've replicated on just 100 acres, and go to 1,000 acre scale. You've got to change like your scale of where your mind's at. You're so focused on your property, which is great, but take your property and multiply it by 10. Imagine how good that neighborhood's going to become. And 1,000 acres, from what you're saying, Hunter, is still a third of what the low end of the average co-op can be across the country. So it's like we are so caught up, let's just say, in our personal property that it's hard to get out of that mindset and begin to think on a scale that is hard to fathom and manage. But when you do that, the degree of impact is so grand. And I think that there's probably a lot of other maybe neighbors that are wanting to be able to go and do this work, but they don't know how to get started. Maybe you can be that person to help them get going, or you've got a contact list of preferred contractors that you can pass along to these other people. From a co-op standpoint, that's another humongous pro. And I know, Hunter, we've spoke on this in the past, but you've seen, you know, the ability for a contractor to come into a co-op, let's say a contractor from Prescribed Fire to TSI to food plotting to a logger. You come in now that you have a cumulative group of like-minded landowners, you might have the benefit of hiring a dozer guy for 6 months just to work on all your co-op land, or a logger. He hopped from one property to another property and to another property to another one. Right there in a focal small unit of land, he's probably going to give preferred prices because he doesn't have to travel and mobilize as much. Like, there's so many benefits, man.
Yeah, no, I mean, you hit the nail on the head there. I mean, one of the biggest things we've seen, and I'll give you a few examples real quick, but, you know, one co-op I work with, they have a layer on a mapping, you know, Google Earth or ArcMap or whatever it may be that they're using, and they keep a layer of what they've burned across their landscape. Now, they're in the Quail Woods, and they, you know, they do a lot of Prescribed Fire, sure, but they're trying to look at their, let's say, 20,000 acre cooperative, mimic what a lot of these large plantations that are 20 and 30,000 acres are doing as individual landowners that own 1,000,
sure,
or own 500. And so they can get the benefit. Now, granted, you're not hunting your neighbor's property, but you're getting the population scale benefit, population level benefit from that connectivity and the refuge that it gives to, let's say, quail or fawns or whatever it may be. So you're getting that, and they have this list, this map they share among their cooperative members that, hey, we burned this year, or we burned that this year. And they can keep an idea of what's getting burned on what part of the cooperative, which helps with interspersion, it helps with disturbance. And then not only that, but when you mention being able to have a logger come, they're not going to come to a property. We run into a lot. I mean, I'm in forestry, and we're a forestry consulting business, and a lot of our properties, if people come to us and they say, we've got 20 acres, 30 acres, we're like, well, sorry, it's not worth the logger's time to come sit on a property, move the equipment there, and then lose a day moving equipment on both ends to make a little bit of money and cut it in a day. Because they can cut large acreages in a short amount of time, depending on what's there. So being able to actually aggregate properties and then do timber sales or timber thins, whatever that may be on that property, incentivizes loggers to come in and do habitat management that might not otherwise be done.
Absolutely.
So I think that people don't see the whole benefit that can happen when you think about having those large acreages, because not only, you know, are you getting the benefit of having them come and do this 10% improvement, if it's a thin for southern pine plantation, or, you know, reduced basal area to get down these very low, you know, open evergreen systems, that are maintained with fire, but you're getting all those landowners then get checks. You're getting the revenue that you would not have gotten that they can put back into those properties that they see fit to increase the quality of the habitat and the management that they get to do, whether that means hiring a contractor if they don't have time to put in fire breaks, or to hire a contractor to come in and a trapper, you know, to trap 10,000 acres on a large scale in the spring for nest predators or coyotes or whatever that may be, whatever they want to spend their money on that they think they don't have time to do, that having that connection across property boundaries allowed them to do that.
Absolutely.
So I think it's something people don't think about.
The other thing that is hugely important is, and we utilized it like yesterday, was working with the landowner for a prescribed fire line, a neighboring landowner. How many times are you looking at like habitat types? You're like, man, that would be really nice if I didn't have to put in a firebreaker on this, you know, 500 yard line. I'd like to be able to go to my neighbors and use their road system that's just right there. They haven't burnt in a couple of years. You have the ability, because there's open lines of communication, to be able to utilize that and be able to burn and have contractors come in and burn if you don't have the experience. The more acreage or the ease of a fire, because you have permanent fire breaks, you can get better rates on prescribed fire per acre with most contractors. So there's not only financial benefits of doing all of this, there's obviously the habitat is improved, and then the wildlife benefits are incredible. And we talk about a lot about in the past. I know you've chatted with him, and I think actually probably professor of yours, but Michael Chamberlain, and the research that we had a podcast on. We were at NWTF. Is, listen, turkey populations and rearing of turkeys, they're covering large land masses. Quail can cover larger land masses than a lot of people think. Average home range for deer, and we're not talking core area, talking home ranges, we're in the 500-600 acre mindset. Like that's territory wise acreage, what we're talking about. So it's only advantageous to work with others in close proximity to you.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think and I know Dr. Chamberlain well. I think, you know, he kind of hits home on that with even not only turkey home ranges, but when you look at like trying to institute predator trapping and
oh my gosh, that's a whole nother story. But
and
yes.
I mean, just looking at the downfalls that you can have there, thinking that, you know, you're having a big impact on that acreage when you could be having an impact on a larger scale at a certain time window to help certain species, you know, whether it be fawns or quail or nesting, you know, nesting up on birds, whatever that may be.
Sure.
I think that the other thing that you kind of hit that we may have forgot about is you don't just get the financial input or the open line of communication. You really get a sense of community and possibly a friend. I mean,
sure.
At a simple level, those relationships can turn into some of the best relationships that you ever had with people that are like-minded, that are deer hunters, turkey hunters, you know, habitat managers that you have right in your backyard. That, you know, if you need help, you know, for example, in our cooperative back home, our neighbor has a bobcat skid steer. We don't. If we need a fire break put in, there you go. If we need a field cleared out, a food plot put in, he's willing to do that. We'll go over and, you know, we do some trapping on his property. You know, we get kind of trading services, not really trading, but, you know, kind of you help that your person, they help you.
Yeah.
You help your neighbor.
They're going to find value in your skill set, and you find value in his equipment. And if they equal out, gosh, that's a perfect fit.
For sure. For sure. And it builds relationships. So I think that's really the key thing that we bring it back to. And a lot of our research, we not only looked at landscape demographics or landscape, you know, composition, what was actually on the landscape. We did a survey to over 2,800 co-op members across those states and looked at their satisfaction with their deer hunting prior to cooperative formation. And currently we looked at what their motivations were. We looked at all these different things that impact cooperatives, because from our aspect and from what we've been talking about, you get you obviously see the landscape benefits. You see that there's these, you know, and if you dive into the research, you can see there's increases of certain land covers.
Sure.
And that you're getting more edge of certain land covers. You're getting more, you know, more patches of these land covers.
Fragmentation.
And that can obviously increase biodiversity and different things that you're thinking about from habitat management and wildlife management. But you're getting that. And so by a function of getting that, what is creating successful cooperatives? Because if we want to get that as an output, let's say in our conservation utility, is increased conservation on the landscape by private landowners across the United States.
Yeah.
How do we make them successful? And that starts with people. So you have to look at what the landowners are getting out of it, what is their motivations for cooperatives, and then how do you make them successful? Because there's co-ops that have started and failed.
Sure.
And I've got a feeling that, you know, with the generational shift, a lot of the average age of our co-op members in this research was in their mid to late 50s. And you're going to see that it's an increasing challenge, that next generation taking on these properties.
Yeah, absolutely.
And being connected to the properties and creating continuing that cooperative. So looking at what makes them successful, what makes them start, what makes them tick, that's how you get the recipe to create that same success across the landscape. So we looked at both sides of that, which is kind of what we've been hitting on this entire time about the human aspect and what the motivations are. But it's important to realize one leads to the other and why they're both important.
Yeah, without a doubt. So what are some of the overall, do you have numbers to provide from the hunter satisfaction that increased pre-co-op and post or being a part of a co-op?
Yeah, so there's been some research done. Some Mitterling did some research up in Michigan and found an increasing in cooperative hunter satisfaction. We actually found some that mirrored just like she did. It was about a 15% increase in overall satisfaction on a 0 to 100 scale from prior to cooperative formation to post co-op formation or current day. So you're looking at about 57% were satisfied with their hunting, which is almost a flip of a coin, a little higher than that.
Sure.
All the way up to 73% roughly.
Wow.
That were satisfied. So when you think about the satisfaction of what these cooperatives are providing to their members, that's what's important. But the craziest thing is that, you know, you think, and I think we all get lulled in this idea that all deer hunters or all QDMers or all whoever, they're all the same. They all want the same thing. They just want big deer. They want more wildlife. They want, but it's funny. We were looking and we did some cluster analysis on this research to figure out based on motivational questions. We gave them a wide array of motivational questions to see how they answered. And we were actually able to parse out what motivation group a group of respondents was based on how they answer these questions.
Mm-hmm.
And we found there was four distinct groups in this research. So they're not all the same. And what's so important about that is that you don't get a cookie cutter co-op member. You've got people that are coming into these cooperatives from multiple different backgrounds and trying to figure out what they want to gain from these cooperatives. They all have different motivations for that.
Sure.
And they all answer kind of similarly. And what's funny is we kind of grouped them into four categories, and without getting into too much jargon of the research, it's we had these members that were really focused on solitude.
Mm-hmm.
They're really focused on, and then we had another group that's really focused on social members. And then we had a group that was pretty large. It was quality harvest. It was really, really motivated by the quality of the deer they harvested because these were deer management cooperatives. And then we had a representative member that really was motivated by almost all of it. So kind of the fully bought in, you know, maybe land and legacy type, you know, client or whoever maybe that you think of as the normal client. Mm-hmm. They were definitely a large percentage, but we found these three other groups that kind of were on their own. And it's funny because, you know, when you think about the number of people we had in the survey, we had roughly 440 responses out of the 2,800 people that we sent out to. Yeah. We actually got some response from, but you know, those groups were slightly smaller. You had about 50 people in the solitude members. You had about 80 to 85 members and social members. And you had 90, 91 members in quality harvest, and you had 210 to 215 in that representative member. So there is, I think it goes without saying that not everyone in that cooperative is the same. They're not coming in for the same reasons, and different things are going to satisfy that member. So having a, you know, diversity of points of what we're trying to accomplish, not just quality beer, not just quail populations, not just non-game, but having all those into one with a wildlife cooperative, wildlife management cooperative, is so important with actually getting these things to take that next step. Because I think deer hunters are practicing them across the landscape at a pretty good rate. Maybe not everybody, not everywhere, but that's where they started, because people realize they can't grow mature deer, you know, extremely regularly without working with your neighbor, unless you own a lot of land. And I think that that is one of those things that spurred cooperatives and deer management cooperatives and QDM cooperatives. But taking the next step and integrating other needs in there, other motivations for the member that may not just be there for the quality mature buck, that may not be there for, you know, the big turkey, whatever that may be. So I think that's important, looking at it and realizing that we are a diverse group of deer hunters and land managers that occupy these things and create these things on a landscape.
Yeah, and I think that's also super refreshing to people who may be apprehensive and say, well, that's not necessarily for me. That's just a trophy deer hunter. Or maybe that co-ops are just for this group, whatever it may be. There's room for everybody. And, you know, my mind just goes right back to that that private landowner who's sitting there in the tree stand and hearing all the gunshots around him opening day, and he's just sitting there discouraged and disappointed, and everyone's like, yeah, I've been there. I know that feeling. I know what it's like. Guys, when that shot rings off, if you're a part of co-ops, that's more of like, wow, I wonder which deer they got. Or it's, I know, it's a refreshing, like, encouraging, hey, that's my friend. He just probably harvested a great deer. Good for him. Like, it's a positive thing. It's not like I have to sit there and wonder what's going on. Or, hey, everyone's kind of roughly on the same page, on the same board. And I know how much deer move across the landscape and utilize different portions of properties and just home range sizes. I'm like, if I'm sitting on 100 acres and I'm surrounded by a lot of great neighbors, I'm sitting there thinking during the rut, I don't know what's coming. I don't know what could show up, but I know that it could be good, rather than saying, oh, the only chance I've got is a basket six coming by me if it comes from the north, because they shoot anything over there. It's like, no, you don't have to play those games anymore. You don't have to sit there and wonder. There's a peace of mind that can come from this. And I know that's kind of like selfish, but we're all out there to have fun and be successful. I get that. I'm just as guilty. But maybe that's your fuel to get going. I think, but once you see the camaraderie, once you see the habitat, and you see that open line of communication begin to take place and unfold, I don't see like a regret like happening. And I don't know if you have research on this, Hunter, and I'd be surprised if it was substantial, but like, you have people who are like, like kind of like backpedaling out of a co-op situation, or is it more like, You don't see like co-ops decrease in size, do you?
Not really. I mean, when we're looking at across landscape, there was a few that we would contact that would say, well, we're really kind of going through a flux year. We've had management, you know, the person that was really kind of heading ours up has either passed away or quit doing it or is kind of in limbo. And you would get that. But what we saw was, you know, with that increased satisfaction level, people that were in these cooperatives were extremely happy about them. And they were happy they were getting recognized, because they're sitting there on the landscape doing these things for the betterment of wildlife, not being picked up by state DNRs for the most part. Now, Missouri Department of Conservation does a great job.
Yeah.
But when you look at somewhere in the South, for example, in Georgia or, you know, other states, they might not utilize them as much. They might just have them, you know, a lot of them do utilize them in their DMAP programs. They do utilize them for getting some news and regulations. And Michigan's a great example. QDMA's talked about this a lot with the CWD testing. They use cooperatives to help facilitate CWD testing. But I think that not only can you utilize them for things like that, but you can really utilize them for your landscape, you know, non-game management. You can utilize them for all these different things that people are not utilizing them for currently. I mean, when we looked at the seven cooperatives that we worked with in Georgia, when you overlay them on a map, the Georgia DNR has a map that of their focal land. It's like a raster layer in ArcMap of their focal landscapes of conservation importance and where they're trying to focus their efforts for all wildlife because of connectivity.
Yeah.
And when you overlaid our seven co-ops on that map, every single one but one hit right on a high importance area. And I thought that was just too crazy to be coincidence. Like you know, we don't have, and I showed it in all my research PowerPoints, you know, the proximity to these areas.
Sure.
And, you know, that kind of brought it full circle for me to realize that these are, you know, they're not, they might not have a contact at the DNR local office. They might not have a contact with the private lands program, whatever state they're in. And they're forming on the landscape by themselves. I think, you know, you asked about them going kind of backwards or backpedaling out of these cooperatives. Most everybody that I'm, you know, either in my cooperative or I work with, they are fully engaged and they are wanting to grow it. There's that limitation of time. Mm-hmm. There's the limitation of resources. And then there's also apprehension at some points of how big do we want to get?
Sure.
Because, you know, obviously you have power in numbers to some extent, but also it increases the meeting sizes. It increases all these things. So that's why I think when you're looking at that acreage, it varies across states. You know, Georgia, and I mentioned at the beginning, the average co-op size ranges from like 3,000 to 5,000 acres, but the average co-op size in Georgia was 9,000 acres. The average cooperative size in Missouri was 3,000 acres.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a huge, you know, difference across the landscape and how the social dynamics come into play.
Absolutely.
And how not only that, but, you know, landscape configuration, as well as property parcel configuration come into play, and land use changes. Obviously, you're going to have more row crops, more managed exotic grasses for hay or whatever that may be in the Midwest or in the Northeast, where you may not have, you're going to have a higher climate that's not as, you know, row crop heavy maybe in the South compared to some other parts of the nation. So you get these differences in landscapes that really are profound when you start looking at landscape configuration and quantifying that. So I think that you're not really seeing people backpedaling as much as they're just working under the radar.
Yeah.
They're flying under the radar and nobody's talking about them. And those that are not talking about them in a holistic context of wildlife and connectivity and utilizing for that, they're in their own silos. So I think that's where we can really take that next level approach to wildlife management cooperatives.
Yeah, without a doubt. And you know, just, you know, candidly speaking, you know, guys like Adam and I, like if someone, a landowner has just 100 acres and they're trying to reach out or they want to reach out from an assistance standpoint, a consultation, maybe they aren't able to do it from a financial standpoint, and they say, well, maybe if I'm part of a co-op and I've got 10 other guys, we got 1,000 acres, we can all pitch in. I only pay a tenth of the price, but they come and do 1,000 acres. They improve all of this. Now we've got the ability to make this thing work. And you're putting more fuel on the fire, and making sure that as a co-op, as a collective, you're moving forward in the right direction and have a strong plan of attack moving forward. And it's just crazy the amount of benefits. And you know, I know that there's no just like cumulative group is trying to educate and communicate and pull data from all these different co-ops across the country. But when you look at it, like those, there's such a rare breed of groups, landowners, or land masses that could provide critical data for, you know, harvest records, observation,
Tree stand sits, predator influences, all these different data points that would be great for state agencies. When you look at, I guess, other land masses that hold such large areas, really it's military bases and large landowners, but maybe they don't have the record keeping that these guys do. So to me, they play a big role. And truthfully, I think from not only a real estate point of view, but also a land and wildlife management perspective, co-ops are the thing of the future. Like, they're going to only increase in as I guess looking forward 5-10 years in prevalence, because if we don't, the land sizes and the potential downward trend of some things that we're seeing, we're going to have to come together. We're going to have that sense of community and that sense of working together collectively as a unit, unified goal, to make the impacts that we're wanting to see on the landscape. We always hear about, the good old days, this and that. I don't want to, I'm not being negative, but if we want to keep the good old day mentality and the success of hunting, we are going to have to reach across the property line and shake a hand and work together. And especially in states, let's say such as Michigan, where your property size is 40 to 80 acres. That's a big chunk. Like, it's very, very common for multiple hunters to be on 20 and 30 acres. And so you've got to work with larger groups of people, I think, to make this habitat, vegetation, plant community, landscape impact that a lot of people are learning about and wanting, desiring on the landscape itself. So I'm definitely encouraged that there's groups out there who are doing it across the country. And quite frankly, Hunter, I think and I hope that this conversation's been encouraging for those who have always wondered, one, what a co-op was, but what the benefits are and how to get started on it. So there's one last thing I want to ask you, it's essentially, what's like that opening line, or that maybe it's of a letter, or maybe it's you pick up the phone or you go and introduce yourself to a landowner. But what is that like conversation, first minute, look like for someone who's just kind of nervous to get going, but they know they want to provide them that quick breakdown of how to successfully establish or start a co-op? What does that conversation look like?
Well, and I'll start, there's not really any cookie cutter line. I wish there was that silver bullet of, you go to every landowner and you say this and that works.
Right.
It just doesn't happen. So I think what I've always tried to do and what I've seen work best is you go up to somebody, shake their hand, maybe not right now, but
yeah.
You have that, you let their guard down. You ask them, hey, do y'all deer hunt? I heard some shots over here. And they kind of say, no, my son does, or no, I do, or we have a hunting club over here, whatever that is.
Yep.
And you start getting a feel for what they are. They let their guard down. They give you some information about what they're doing, what they like to do, and you can kind of gauge the conversation for which way to go after that.
Sure.
They may say something in that conversation and says, yeah, my son-in-law shot this last year. They show you a picture on their phone.
Mm-hmm.
Or they do, and so you know where to go and how to navigate that situation based on the cues that they're giving you.
Sure.
And that's if they say, yeah, well, we practice QDM, well, that's green light. Like, okay, we're in the door as far as like, hey, have you ever heard of co-op?
Yep.
Or have you ever heard of these things, or have you, how big's your property, those kind of things. And then you slowly kind of wade into those waters, because you don't want to come off as, I only want to be in this to better myself.
Sure.
What you want is you want to go up to that property owner, that landowner, and say, I want to help you. And if it helps me, great.
Yeah.
But I want, like, being selfless in that aspect and having some humility, knowing that not everybody practices what you do.
Sure.
And whether, I'm the perfect person to say, I've always thought, the way I manage deer for QDM is the best way for me and can be a great way for other people. But just understanding and realizing that not everybody does that, and that it may take some time for everybody to come around to whatever that great or that perfect management strategy is for them. And knowing how to navigate that to break down barriers and not build barriers. Because when you do and you come across too aggressive, or you say, well, we only do this or we only do that, trying to one up that landowner or sure. to force them into feeling that they should or they're lesser than, then that's when you really get into problems and you can't do that. And that is one of those things that I would say is a takeaway of, you know, the understanding that some people come from a different era.
Yeah,
they
absolutely.
May have grown up practicing a different form of deer management, more traditional deer management, and interacting with landowners is an art in and of itself. So I think that is the best advice I could give. I will finish off with one of the best kind of things that I ever heard from a co-op member throughout this entire research. Mm-hmm. I talked with 45 co-ops, you know, countless members, read letters, surveys, you know, talked to all the leaders on the phone to get maps, because obviously, you know, a lot of these maps are not public property.
Sure. Yeah.
Talked to the leaders to get the map of where they're actually their co-op is on this rural landscape. And the best piece of advice I got was from a 29,000 acre cooperative in South Georgia. And I asked him, I said, you know, what makes your cooperative so successful? And he said, you know, I can go out and I could spend $500 on food plots in 2 days or a day.
Mm-hmm.
But every year we have a meeting where I put on a hot, I put burgers on the grill. I put, you know, bring bags of chips and drinks, and I have a big cookout, you know, barbecue, whatever it is. And I invite all the property owners in this area over, you know, that are on the co-op, and I tell them to bring their friends, and I can spend $500 in food and a little bit of my time and have an impact on 29,000 acres, or I can spend $500 on a couple acres of food plots.
Sure.
And I think that puts it in perspective when you realize just how selfless and how you should think about these things of being bigger than your property or bigger than your,
yes.
you know, your back 40 or whatever that is, to start thinking about the landscape and think about others and how your property is a piece and how maybe it can be the cornerstone in that landscape to create these situations with co-ops that not only benefit yourself, but will benefit people around you. They'll benefit your kids, your family. And you'll create some really amazing relationships along the way, and just being humble and selfless throughout that interaction, and knowing that that you're in it for the greater good, that in turn affects your property for the betterment of its own, for the betterment of the land that you're on.
I think that's fantastic point. You don't have to physically go and cut trees or go and spray noxious weeds on your co-op members' properties, but you are a direct beneficiary and point of origin for all that conservation effort that's going out there. To all those co-op leaders or all those people who are like wondering, well, is it worth my time? Absolutely, it's worth your time, because without maybe you being a point of contact or you leading or starting this group, your region, your neighborhood isn't going to be as beneficial. When we're talking water quality, we're talking air quality, we're talking diversity of rare exotic plant species, as well as animals that could be conserved through these efforts, that could be on you. That could be your impact or your devotion to your region. If you love your area, this could be something much greater than the 500 acres that you own. Get out there and move beyond, let's say, the property boundaries, the purple paint that your property falls within. There's a greater and a larger impact that can be made. It can't be made without taking those initial efforts. And I think that is a great, definitely a great point and something to kind of leave people on. But is there anything else, Hunter, that you would say, you know, kind of leave people with from what you found through all the research of studying these co-ops from across the country?
Well, I think I've said it a few times, but I would say this, Matt, they're not all the same.
Yeah.
They're not all going to start the same, and they're not all going to be, you know, monster 20,000 acre plus co-ops. They're not all going to be small co-ops. There is no cookie cutter. Yep. There is the only thing they all share in common is a love for the land that they're on and the betterment of leaving it better than they found it. And I think that is such a huge driving factor in managing deer, turkey, game, non-game, and the land cover and the habitats in which they reside. So I think that is just that holistic approach and how it really brings together not only the landscape, but the community. And when you have a community buy-in and you have landowners that are going down the road and waving at each other, they're stopping at tailgates and, you know, congratulating them on the 5.5-year-old buck they killed that you've been watching for 3 years because you all have history with it. Yes. And you are, you know, you've got a kid that is going to kill their first turkey, and the turkeys were not there in that amount or that abundance 5-10 years ago. And it was because the co-op formed, or it was, you know, you've got, you know, you're training a bird dog and they have quail there now because they didn't prior, but it's all because of that person starting a co-op, or the people that are instrumental in forming and maintaining the cooperative that was created and happened to be in your area. So I think that the one thing I would say is don't think that I can't do it. When I started the cooperative at my parents' house, I was 12 years old. I went over to the neighbor's property. The guy was 50 years old. And I said, hey, you know, I kind of used the same type thing of, you know, we shot this deer over here. You know, what are y'all doing? They had just bought the property. And it was a handshake of saying, yeah, we practice the same type of management. And it grew from there. And now it's 1,200 acres. Mm-hmm. Not the largest cooperative in the world. But it was a stepping stone to be able to get to that end goal. And now we sit there and we, you know, we'll sit in the stand and send pictures back and forth and say, I just saw this nice 2.5-year-old 7-pointer. He's headed your way. You know, like, we'll get those kind of things happen that you would never have thought it would have happened 10 or 15 years ago. And I think that, you know, just as a parting message, we need these cooperatives are the way of the future. Like you said, you're going to have I think I read a statistic about 2 years ago, and we were at a wildlife society meeting, and they said that over 40% of the land in the United States is going to change hands in the next 20 years.
Yeah.
And I think that is such an important statistic when you think of the impact that we can have to conserve these lands, but also the importance of relationships, meeting the landowner that bought the property next to you, meeting the landowner that's owned it for 50 years, and being able to conserve these landscapes, and then utilizing cooperatives for conservation benefit, not just for producing a quality mature deer or producing a quail, but for ecosystem services, for water quality, for habitat connectivity. And one thing people don't think about is having a cooperative in place to have an efficient channel of conservation dissemination. If there is a outbreak of CWD, if there is a topic of conservation concern, whatever it may be, having landowners willing and ready to be on a landscape, connected to their property, and connected with their neighbor to take on whatever challenges we have in the future for wildlife management is probably the most important reason to continue to form cooperatives. And it's a reason that they are going to be integral in the future of wildlife conservation, not just from populations, but from actually conserving that land and leaving it better than you found it for the next generation, because we're going to have a lot of fights on our hands with encroachment, with habitats dwindling. The largest single reason for species declines across the world is loss of habitat and fragmentation. And by being able to use the enthusiasm of deer hunters, turkey hunters, quail hunters, you know, just wildlife enthusiasts, or the lady down the road that loves her wildflowers and bees.
That's right.
You are going to be able to conserve landscapes and having those shared interests for the betterment of the future of that land.
Absolutely. I think you hit the nail on the head there in a lot of different ways. It's coming, and I think it's probably one of the best trends, let's say, in wildlife management, or trains that you can jump on, be a part of, be a leader on, and you're going to have a fantastic impact, and the wildlife need it. I mean, they really do. The landscapes need it. So there's a lot of degraded properties and things that are just mismanaged that collectively with more education, more presence, and more knowledge out there, we can do so much more just from a society standpoint. So I'm encouraged by it, man, and I hope everyone else is too. Hunter, certainly appreciate your time on the podcast and sharing this research and your just general knowledge and involvement with co-ops, because, like I said, they're a huge important factor into wildlife management as we see it right now, and certainly more into the future. So thank you for coming on and sharing your time and sharing your knowledge.
Yeah, no, Matt, it's definitely my pleasure, and I will I'll say this and just kind of a selfless plug here at the end. The research is coming out in Quality Whitetails. Mm-hmm. It was QDMA and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service funded. So the in-depth articles, we're going to have two articles coming out in Quality Whitetails that goes over both parts, the landscape and the survey. So awesome. For any of your listeners that are QDMA members, we should be coming out with those over the next year. It'll be published, and we just had the first accepted paper. Here in the last week and a half. So it's going to be disseminated out there. We worked on this for the last 2016 to 2018. And so we're just kind of getting it out there. And we are excited to share this research with everybody. And, you know, there's more things coming down the pipeline of to help cooperatives and to kind of help cooperatives, not only in these states, but across the United States. I think everybody will really get a lot out of those articles and the things to come. So,
and if you aren't a QDMA member, shame on you. Go sign up. You should be a part of that group. Be able to get great information through Quality Whitetails, the magazine, on a, I guess, bi-monthly basis. So be sure to check that out, guys. Sign up, be a QDMA member. Hunter, thank you again for your time. Guys, we will catch you next week. Yeah.